this is Laura.
Hi, Laura.
Hi.
This is Bill and Joanne.
Can you hear us okay?
Yep, hear you great.
Oh, good.
Hi, this is Jeff Sand.
Hi, Jeff. Laura Joplin here.
Laura,
hi, Jeff. This is Phil, and Joanne's sitting beside me.
Oh, great. I'm glad you guys were able to join today, too, amongst your travels.
Well, thank you.
Well, good. Rob should be joining here a little bit. I know there's a number of other folks that said they were going to try and call in.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Rob Raquin.
Rob.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Joanne.
Good. Good. Well,
and here's one more.
Thank you for joining this afternoon. We record these conferences, as you know, from your dial-in, and then post them on our website. So at the risk of jumping in before everyone has joined us, I'll just go ahead and start with kind of a big picture overview, and then please feel free to ask questions by interrupting me or send an email to myself or Jeff at the Raquin Group during the course of my comments, and then I'll open it up to questions a little bit later, and we'll see how that works, okay?
Okay.
Good. We had a really good time yesterday afternoon here in Santa Fe at the sort of in-person tea, as we call them. I guess we don't serve a lot of tea. We serve a lot of sweets, however, and I say that helps keep people awake during the course of my introductory remarks, and I'm sorry I can't transmit some sugar or caffeine energy across the telephone wires, but hopefully you'll let me know if I am going on too long here. We have, as anyone who reads the newspapers or watches TV knows, have had a stellar stock and bond market performance so far in 2013 after an excellent 2012. The performance of the financial markets has far outstripped the performance of the real economy in terms of national output, in terms of job creation, all kinds of measures. And one of the telltale signs of how far the markets have come is that I read a statistic that the top 6% of the nation in wealth terms has gained about 10% over the last 3 or 4 years since the financial crisis, while the bottom 96% has lost wealth. And that's not a surprise. It's really a continuation of the trend that we saw through the early parts of the new millennium. But as that's continued on, we have this great dispersion of the results of people who own financial assets with vis-a-vis people who are working for a living for the most part. There's been some relatively good news on the economic front, that is that the U.S. is not in a recession, that the nation's output is growing, albeit at a lower rate than what even reported inflation is. Most analysts think that the U.S. is growing a little under 2% a year, and that's the projection going forward. And that inflation, at least reported inflation, is running at about the same level. So another piece of good news is that the deficit that has gotten a lot of press is actually declining. And what most people don't realize, as the reports of tax receipts come in here, in the April, you know, March, April, May time frame, is that the one time the expiring tax cuts in 2012 and the increase in the capital gains rate caused many people to realize profits in 2012 so that they would pay the lower tax rate. So what we're seeing is this kind of bulge in tax receipts, which people are saying is taking off the pressure, off the political pressure for the Democrats and Republicans to reach some kind of long-term plan to reduce the deficit. And that pressure is off somewhat because of tax receipts. I think this is a one-time kind of a deal. And when we get to next year at this time, tax receipts will be down dramatically because people are not taking gains unless they have to in 2013. So that's kind of a superficial piece of good news, but one that is encouraging the market. It's amazing when you look at the stock market activity. It's like, to me, there's an invisible hand propping it up from underneath. Because even bad news about unemployment or manufacturing activity doesn't really make the market go down. And a typical saying that people have, or a feeling they have about the market, is, oh, it's so volatile, it goes up and down so much. There has been, I think, remarkably little volatility, especially on the downside, the last two or three years, almost as if the big players, whoever they may be, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any means, but that the big money really does not want to see individual investors spooked again by a market that is going down, because the consequences, as we'll go into a little bit later on the call, are so dire for a loss of confidence that everyone really wants the market to stay up. So I think we have very little downside risk, at least if it's within the Federal Reserve and the institutional players' purview to affect the market. Turning our attention to the deficit again, I'll talk a little bit about Europe and Japan here just for a moment. Europe is in a recession. They've had six consecutive quarters of negative growth, that is shrinking of the size of their economic output. And as everyone knows, the unemployment situation is really terrible in the southern European countries. I won't even call it the periphery, which is what some people used to call it, because it's really the whole southern part. The Spain, Italy, Greece, Crete, Portugal, that those countries really are in depression-like circumstances. And it's a very interesting topic of the European Union and the euro as a currency. I think they're two separate things and will become more and more separate as time goes on. But the European economy as a whole is declining. They are locked into policies where they cannot take acts in the southern countries without the northern countries' cooperation, and they either need to transfer money from the north to the south, or actually have great austerity in the south, which creates even slower economic growth. And that looks to be a self-perpetuating kind of a situation, unless there's kind of a political breakthrough, which is very unlikely given the structure and the tenor of things over there. So we're looking at Southern Europe really dragging down the European Union for the next few years. The European Union makes up a little under one-fifth of the world's economy. That, combined with China's slow down from 8 or 9 or 10% growth to somewhere around 6 or 7 is definitely impacting the prospects for growth worldwide. And a growth, organic kind of private enterprise growth, is the great hope that people have that all of these measures that the governments and banks have taken, that's the great hope that growth will allow people to pay off their debts and kind of restart their engines from a social point of view. So what we're doing here is we are issuing, I should say, the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury and the large banks, and I mean the 6 sort of mega banks, the too big to fail banks, and government agencies like the home loan agencies and the student loan agencies and the pension funds, the very large pension funds, are sort of locked into a situation where they're supporting each other and expanding the size of the institutional reach as a whole. And I'm going to use a word that I coined yesterday kind of by accident. I'm going to call it the house, like we were in Las Vegas and you're going to the Sands casino or whatever. I don't even know the names of them. Caesar's Palace. And you come in, that's the house. And the government is now the house. The government and the banks and the big banks are holding the cards. They are creating more and more chips. And they do this by the tune of issuing new bonds or buying bonds and from one another. One it's like a family where one cousin writes a piece of paper and the other cousin buys it and then the other cousin trades it and then the fourth cousin holds it as collateral, hopefully to do something in the real world. So there's this kind of intra family stuff going on, and to the tune of, in our country, about $85 billion a month, or $1 trillion a year. That's the growth rate of the amount of poker chips that are on the table that the house controls. And when you read about Ben Bernanke or about bond buying or quantitative easing, 1, 2, 3, infinity, whatever they call it, they're essentially talking about creating new poker chips, passing them around the table, all in the hope of generating organic, sustainable economic growth that is entrepreneurial growth, growth that actually creates jobs, not McDonald's types job or government jobs, but jobs in private industry. And that is the big question, whether this expansion of the size of the house's bank or cards or poker chips will in effect do anything that it's supposed to do is still unanswered. Nonetheless, in the process of creating these additional poker chips, people have more money to pay for stocks or to pay for bonds. And that is the reason why the markets have been going up, is because we have $1 trillion a year in the U.S. We have China, and no one can really tell what goes on inside China, but they have been creating their own paper wealth in order to kind of cover over their very terrible banking system, their very terrible, inefficient transportation system. They have cities that sit vacant because building them created jobs. And it's hard for us to conceive of the kind of life and political pressures that exist in China. Nonetheless, they are creating financial wealth. Not that they don't have wealth, real wealth from U.S. dollars, from our trade, from selling things to us. But Europe the reason Europe has stabilized at least the European financial markets, not their actual industrial or employment markets, but their financial markets are stable because the European Central Bank has pledged to create as many new piles of poker chips as is necessary to support whoever needs it, be it Greece or Spain. Not so much Cyprus. We'll come back to what the people in Cyprus have to endure now. But in general, and just recently, I'm sure most of you have heard, the Bank of Japan and the new prime minister in Japan has decided to just jump on this same horse and go for broke to just create more poker chips. And so as a result, the Japanese stock market is up about 40%, 45% this year. They are devaluing their currency to make their exports more affordable. And all of that is really a sea change in Japan. It really means that Japan has jumped on the same bandwagon that the U.S. has led. Europe has opened the gates to that, even though, according to their prior pacts, it's illegal. And so you see the German central banker suing the European Union for breaking their contract and essentially creating more of these poker chips when by law they're not supposed to do that. So we have a concerted worldwide effort to expand the size of their balance sheet, the size of the poker table. The hope is that this increase the result of the increase in the size of the poker table is that if you sit on the sidelines in CDs or in savings or in bonds, you earn practically nothing. We've been faced with this situation that's gotten worse and worse, and a good bonds are impossible to find. People living on fixed incomes, retired people, savers who are essentially conservative, who want to protect their capital, have no place to go. And that is in the absolute intention of the people who are creating new poker chips, is to force everyone else to go someplace else and play a different game in the casino. Go play poker, go play roulette, play blackjack, but don't sit on the side. Because if you sit on the side, you're going to earn nothing. And every day here at the Raccoon Group, we have clients who are elderly, whose kids are telling them you can't just sit with a conservative stance. You've got to go take more risk because you need 4 or 5% in income. And there is no way to get 4 or 5% in income without taking some risk. And of course, our job is to diversify that risk, to hedge it if we can, to make the right decisions, but there is risk nonetheless. And at some point, which I'll mention, there are consequences to this expansion of the playing table. And one possible outcome is that it works, that growth worldwide comes back into play. It certainly is possible. You have increasing populations in India and Asia that are educated, that are motivated, hardworking. They have the entrepreneurial spirit. I'm not sure that exists given the constraints on entrepreneurial activity in the U.S. and Europe and Japan. Japan being one of the least entrepreneurial kinds of environments, and Europe next. Maybe that has to do with the high quality of living there. I understand the Japanese. It's really nice to live in Japan if you're Japanese. And the same thing's true in Europe. I was in Germany recently, had a great time, was totally impressed with the German lifestyle. It's clean, it's green, there's good quality food, people are polite, they're honest. There's lots of cultural activities, education and medical care is good. It was really amazing. And, I'm not sure if that's unique to Germany, there really are some very positive things going on in Europe. And, maybe people there are somewhat entrepreneurial. I joke when people are here in the office, I always turn to Juliana or someone, and Juliana's walking around the office without shoes, and she thinks that I've become an arch conservative or libertarian in my 50s, as opposed to being, I don't know what I was earlier, and it's partially true. I really am not a long-term believer that the government can supplant private industry or entrepreneurial activity on a small scale in job creation or in lots of areas. At least I'm not that interested in it. So the hope, and this was the hope that everyone remembers that happened maybe for the wrong reasons during the Reagan era in the 80s and the Clinton years, is where the economy was growing based on private enterprise. Lots of abuses, certainly, of that, and I use the example of the healthcare field, in that the costs are going up. There are fewer and fewer young doctors who even want to have their own practices, much less have the business or paperwork ability to deal with the high level of paperwork. And so, healthcare becomes an institutional activity through the hospitals or insurance companies or whomever. And someone asked the question yesterday afternoon, well, is there another motivation to have these institutions getting so large and to have the government getting involved in it? And maybe there is another motivation for the government to really get involved in some kind of single-payer system that's politically not possible, but when people are just used to working for large institutions, and those of us that can't afford to just go to a private doctor that doesn't take insurance, that everyone gets used to a different kind of a system, and we become more like Europe in that sense. I'm not sure, but I digress. So back to the economy, the unemployment rate in the U.S. is down slightly. I think everyone realizes that this poker game, that the commitment on the part of the Federal Reserve has been to keep interest rates near zero until unemployment gets to 6.5%. Well, of course, they publish the statistics, and so they can keep the unemployment rate wherever they want. It's a very inexact science. They report unemployment now at 7.5%, which is kind of the reelection rate for Democrats, because that's considered to be a good progress from where it was a couple of years ago. I don't really believe that it's 7.5%. I think there are many people who have given up looking for work, people who are working two or three or part-time jobs, young people who are not counted, who are out of high school or college, who can't find full-time work, certainly not work with benefits. Plenty of people who are over 60 now who are looking for second jobs to supplement Social Security. I think most of those people are not counted in the unemployment numbers. Still, Europe's unemployment rate is almost double that here in the United States. It's 12% overall. That takes into account Germany's very low unemployment rate of 3-4%. That's offset by Spain's unemployment rate of 27%. Unemployment in the sort of 20-25-year-old age bracket is over 50%. So we do have a fair amount of things to be grateful for in terms of the economic performance here in the U.S. The follow-on question, really, the next topic with that overview about the economy, and maybe I'll just stop for a second to see if there are any questions from what I've just covered. All right.
Rob, I have a question. How is Europe, like you mentioned Germany being in such good shape, how is that going to affect the rest of Europe?
Well, the big question is whether Germany will agree to pay for the sins of Southern Europe. And as long as Germany is relatively prosperous, which it is, the sort of the hangover of guilt from World War II and the desire to be the leaders of a unified Europe, which is a longtime sort of German psychic goal, will be served by them playing on the team, on Team Europe. And so that's the good effect. Another good effect is that basically Germany is an export-driven nation. They make things and they sell them to the rest of Europe. So they need those other markets. It's a little bit like us and China needing each other. There's a symbiotic relationship. So there's a lot of impact of Germany's prosperity on Europe. If Germany wasn't relatively prosperous, there would be just huge cracks, especially because countries like France are really in quite bad financial shape. And France is the kind of country that just, I don't think it's ever kind of gotten over the French Revolution, not that it needs to get over it, just in the sense that they have certain inalienable rights, and those come before the economy. You can't kick a tenant that's not paying their rent out of their apartment in Paris. It's very difficult to fire people in France. And so with that kind of attitude, that kind of sucks an economy dry when it doesn't have real growth going on, because people lean more and more on government aid. And Germany is essentially providing aid to the rest of Europe. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome. So let me go on and talk about what the risks are and what the possible scenarios are and what the strategies are in dealing with this expanded poker game. And you'll have to excuse me, I kind of am into this analogy of the economy with the house in Las Vegas. It just helps me simplify a lot of the concepts, and so if I beat that one to death, I apologize. So what we have are we have is the situation where interest rates are zero. The economy is kind of limping along. Big companies have made money by cutting costs. A lot of that is cutting jobs. Every day on the financial news, I see another company cutting thousands of jobs. And I just wonder, where are the jobs being created? They're in government and in some in retail. There certainly are plenty of jobs in technical areas that there are not enough people to fill, people in computer programming or engineering type jobs. And so it's not like the job market is one great bad situation, because I think in the technical areas it really is quite good. But the fear that people have is that the economy will limp along, there will not be jobs created, and that the big kind of not so sleeping elephant in the room is people getting older. The demographics of Europe and Japan, I should say Japan is the worst, Europe next, then the U.S., and that Russia's in there, but they're not really a player except in natural resources. And you have the great bulge of population moving towards retirement age, not that they'll be able to retire, and you have fewer people coming into the workforce with experience, education, skills, motivation, because they're coming in now in a recessionary or contraction period. And Japan is as I said, they have the most rapidly aging population, the lowest birth rate. They, of course, do not allow for immigration, which is one big positive for the U.S. if we kind of get our act together. Europe has tremendous immigration, whether it's legal or not, I can't really tell. But we all know that Europe really is a multicultural place now, but Japan is not. And if there's no job growth and wages don't increase, then you will have sort of basically larger and larger disenfranchised parts of the population that haven't worked really ever, that don't have hopes for a career. And that's really what spells trouble for the long-term social institutions, like people paying their taxes, you know, abiding by the laws, et cetera. And that's the big risk in if there is no growth in job opportunities, that the employment just isn't there, and that brings on social pressure. Now, from a financial perspective, the financial risks of the current game that's being played is that, and we see some signs of this, is that no matter how many poker chips are on the table, nobody is really playing the game to take risks. Nobody is creating jobs. Not nobody, that's a little extreme, but not enough jobs are being created. And then you have everyone who's kind of benefiting from the rise in asset prices. We see a rise in real estate prices recently in a lot of parts of the United States. It's starting to happen in Europe too, where people with financial assets are branching out. There's a great kind of unease and very widespread anxiety where people are saying, you know, we're not dumb. We know that our portfolios are worth more, our trust accounts or whatever are worth more, but we just don't feel very good about the future. So what can we do to kind of hedge our risk? And nobody really has an answer to that. We have a couple of answers to it, which I'll go into, but you know, the party is continuing right now because financial assets continue to rise, and people are moving money out of bonds and cash that are earning nothing, as I said before, into stocks, into real estate. The long-term efficacy of those movements can be cut off very, very quickly. And it doesn't have to be where the central banks decide to raise interest rates, because the markets, all that needs to happen is that some player somewhere says, you know, I don't want to play the game anymore. I'm going home. I'm cashing in my chips. I'm going to take 0% return, but I'm going to protect what I have. If one big player does that, let's say it's unlikely to be a public pension fund or any kind of a sovereign wealth fund, because they all understand the interconnectedness of their investment strategy. That is, the Saudis' money has to come out of the ground, be sold to the Europeans, and then reinvested somewhere, and they can only build so many golf courses and ice skating rinks in the desert. There's a limit to that, so they have to put their money elsewhere. And so the world is sort of tied together in this game. Nobody wants to see instability in one part of the world, because it is likely to spread rather quickly, much more quickly than in the past. And it's why when the Bank of Japan starts to print money or buy bonds or reinflate their economy, they do need the cooperation of Europe and the U.S., and they have it, because I don't really know why there's not a competitive devaluation going on, which is everyone understands what happened in the 30s when countries put up tariffs, and that basically shut down world trade. When countries devalue the currency, it's kind of a tariff. It's more widespread and not an official act, but it just means that Japan's businesses now have an advantage over Korean businesses. It's why you see demonstrations in Korea against Japanese and demonstrations in Japan against Koreans is because you have this retreat into sovereign identity. If people feel like their economic well-being is threatened by the actions of other nations, inflation can be exported. We have deflation at the moment, certainly in wages. The price of gold is down, so that's kind of a sign of deflation. We have people earning a negative interest rate on their cash because inflation is over the level that people are earning on cash and short-term bonds. And so the central portfolio question for people with financial assets is, when do you take some of your chips off the table in a way that doesn't upset the game, where people don't panic? And I believe we are already seeing that starting to happen. We see numbers are kind of irrelevant when we talk in these terms. There's like $6 billion a month now coming out of bonds and going into short-term money market funds. Even though it's earning less interest, people are starting to get concerned in very small measure. I'd say, you know, maybe there's a half or a quarter of 1% of the institutional money has decided to turn cautious, which is really quite low. Our strategy is to look and say, how can we take profits? What have we been doing that looks like it's still working but may not work in the future? And there are several things like that. Primarily among them are high dividend paying stocks. That has been one of our central strategies to earn a steady cash flow. It's worked very well. Portfolios are up. Cash flows are solid. There are so many people buying Johnson & Johnson and Procter & Gamble that those stocks are way overvalued. And it doesn't mean they can't stay high in price, but our attitude is we'd rather sell some before the party's over and protect our capital. If we have capital gains to take it, take the taxes. Another area of interest, intense interest on our part, is to watch what we call the junk bond market. That is, companies that are not the IBMs, not the Apple of the world, the companies that have kind of decent financial statements but not great. And this is the junk bond market that typically pays a high rate of interest but no longer does, given the amount of risk. And we are watching that junk bond market. We are actually shorting it, that is, a bit putting bets that it will go down. We think that area far sooner than the government bond market, because the perception is that the U.S. Treasury is sacred, that it is bulletproof, that it will pay no matter what, that it's the safest bet on earth, and it may well be. The junk bond market is likely going to show the first crack in this kind of dike of confidence that's holding up the walls. And we saw it back in 2007. We were in the office. We saw the news that this hedge fund, Cerberus, was unable to sell junk bonds to buy out Chrysler at the time. Of course, Chrysler is now owned by Fiat, so Cerberus failed in 2007 and continues to fail in that effort. But we looked at each other and said, this is the start of the deluge of bad credit, of people not being able to get money to make their loans. Now we have, in 2013 into 2014, we have everyone is giving their money to the government or something that they think the government is going to support, and they assume that that is absolutely 100% good money. And I think that's an erroneous assumption. the first place where that mistake shows up is in the junk bond market. It's not like the companies are too big to fail, like Citigroup or Bank of America. You know, these are the banks that just continuously have to pull down their pants and say, we've been bad. And they're still doing it. People are still uncovering the stupidest things that the banks and the brokerage firms did. How many different ways did they rip off the public? They ripped off municipalities. I saw where the city of Denver just had to pay Goldman Sachs or one of those places like $30 million because Goldman Sachs sold them a very esoteric financial instrument 5 years ago, and now Denver is like sucking wind on that investment and needs to get out of it. And so you have this kind of continuation of the very astute financial players taking advantage of the general public and public employees and public finances. And it hasn't gotten very bad yet, but we think it will. And so we're going to stay clear of the U.S. Treasury market and short the junk bond market. Last fall, we did buy into Japanese stocks. I mostly did it as a trading move because the market tended to move between like 10,000 and 12,000 on the Nikkei. And when it got down to like 9,500, I thought, oh, okay, let's buy some. And now it's at like 14,000. I always say it's better to be lucky than smart. And that goes for me as well. Japan is having a party. Like, they're taking the last 5 years of the U.S. and Europe's kind of largesse and packing it all into this year. So things are pretty crazy over in Japan. Our strategy in dealing with the potential risk to an end to the poker game, or at least a loss of confidence, is to put small amounts of money in these areas that will tell us that the confidence is breaking. And as most people know who have portfolios under our management, we have been shortening up our bond maturities. And when we have bonds mature, we have not been reinvesting them. And that is all kind of not necessarily, I'm not anticipating a Armageddon. And this is not a doom and gloom talk, I hope. You'll have to tell me when I'm done spouting here in a minute. But it's just a cautionary tale that while we have participated in the rise in financial assets, there are so many factors that make it a tenuous party that we want to be well positioned. And that doesn't mean waiting and saying, okay, well, we're going to find out about something before someone else, because we won't. We will all wake up to a new environment when it happens. And so we feel like taking some preemptive activities is warranted. So I think there I'll give all of your ears a little break and see if anyone has questions.
So, Robert, we're at this point, could you give us a point-by-point idea of what your overall strategy is going to be in the next quarter?
Yes. Well, I can tell you what it's going to be this next week. We have been selling out of some master limited partnerships in natural gas. They have been bid up in price so much that it's just unreasonable. And so we've been taking profits and looking for companies in the energy industry. I'm happy to talk if anyone's interested in the energy industry, because there was a lot of press about that. But and buying companies with proven reserves that are relatively inexpensive that also pay decent dividends. So that's one strategy, is to take profits when we feel like a client can bear the sight of you know, shorting the junk bonds or adding money to metals, and you know, gold and silver may continue to go down because of the party being in such good hands, but this is a good time to be buying into those areas, a good time to be buying actual natural gas, the commodity. And again, it may stay down, it may go down further, but natural gas is the logical, clean-burning alternative over the long run. And, of course, the oil companies are resisting the infrastructure to natural gas because it would make their assets less valuable, but we think in the long run natural gas makes a lot of sense. And we continue to look for income producing real estate as a strategy, earning 5-7% on a cash basis as a form of diversification. So that's, and then we buy stocks and trade them, because that's just of interest, but we're always have one eye open for the, you know, when things are overvalued.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
You've talked about concerns for the market. Is it kind of too late to get to participate in the party?
Well, it depends how much you like to dance and how good a dancer you are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't consider myself to be a very good dancer. I'm more of a slow and steady, persistent kind of a guy that likes to walk up mountains than dance. And you know, when we look at our stock list and the companies we'd like to buy, and we look and we say, how many of these are of reasonable value? Can we go out and buy today? They're very, very few, probably under 5% of the stocks that we'd like to buy are priced in a range that I'm comfortable buying them. So I think it is too late. We have, you know, companies that pretty much everyone owns, like the grocery chain in North Carolina, Ingles. It's almost at 22%. And we bought it at 14 or 15 when it was paying a 4% dividend. Siemens, I'm just looking at the stock at the Bloomberg right now. Siemens is a company we bought a lot at 80. It's at 104. And I just wouldn't spend that much money on it. Verizon, Vodafone, all of the telecommunication companies have increased in price so much because people are desperate for cash flow. And as those prices go up, even Intel pays a good dividend. But it's not like it's impossible to earn a good dividend. We bought, you know, a mining company for some people that's paying a 4.5% dividend, and it's also a very inexpensive stock. Now, inexpensive stocks can stay inexpensive for quite some time, but so I think to buy the market as a whole, someone asked yesterday, what about indexes? Mm-hmm. And buying indexes and rebalancing them, that's what you read about in the Wall Street Journal as being sort of the smart thing to do. And I said, you know, it really is a smart thing to do if you're if all you have is a retirement account in a 401k and your options are limited, you can... Index funds are better than most mutual funds, certainly in the U.S. We don't think they're as good internationally. But the problem with it is that if that game comes to an end, the index funds are just sitting ducks. And it's fine even for a portion of anyone's portfolio, but just to blindly allocate money because statistics say that this is what history has brought us in the past, I think is not an adequate strategy going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Any any other questions? Have I put everyone to sleep?
I have a question, Rob. It's Laura Joplin.
Good.
I'm curious, just on a on an investment level, you know, I'm cool with, you know, you're thinking about it. But what I deal with, of course, is living, my the way I live, the way I deal with my personal money to buy or not buy. And in that regard, do you think that there's a certain strategy of lifestyle now that is more appropriate given the nature of the economy? Just in terms of a good time to acquire personal assets, or is it a better time to wait? You know, that sort of thing.
I'm not sure what you mean by personal assets. Certainly.
Another car or a second home, or is it a good time to put solar in? You know, those things.
Yeah, that's actually an excellent kind of big question. So we at least are not in a period of reported high inflation. Unless you're in San Francisco and you want to buy something there, a second home in San Francisco, I am more and more convinced that fewer people will have second homes because of the increasing cost and hassle of owning and maintaining them. The issue about personal spending is, everyone wants to be comfortable. Everyone wants to have a secure future. And the what that means is different to different people, obviously, in terms of lifestyle. But the need to acquire, second cars. I have like five cars personally. I bought them all used. They all serve a function, and I never wash them, which is really unacceptable if you live in California to not wash your car. But in New Mexico, it's sort of the standard. So I think I have five vehicles because I use them for different things, and I can't do anything without those vehicles. I could, I'm sure, make do with them. I think having expenses matched with income, and there's a, you know, this sort of, it sort of raises the generational issue, which is how much to leave to your children, how much is right, is the next generation dependent on the generation that's coming close to retirement age for their assets, for their opportunity? I think they are. I think the opportunities for young people to have a beginning nest egg and, you know, of capital is very, very limited to start businesses or buy homes for the first time, even to pay for their education. And so depending on, and I mean, I know your situation, you know, your family situation, but generalizing your question is that there's, I think people are getting less and less pleasure out of sort of spending money just to spend it rather than having some practical long-term plan. And, you know, the time to buy I was going to talk about this earlier, talking about real estate, but that whole bulge of the population that's moving towards retirement is not going to be buying 5,000 square foot homes that cost $1,000 a month to heat. Now, I may be being ridiculous with the heating bills, but having a very manageable budget of required expenditures going forward, I think, is really important financially as well as personally to most people, no matter how much money they have. That just the hassle factor of dealing with things is increasing all the time. Simplification, sustainability, those are all nice words. It's hard to know what that means person to person. I'm trying to figure that out for my own family. hopefully that answers a little bit of your question.
It addresses it. Thank you.
Okay, good. Fair enough. Before we close, are there any final questions?
No.
Well, thanks everyone for joining us. And if you have any feedback, things you'd like to see covered or not covered next time, just let Jeff or I know.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Thanks everyone. Take care.
Really appreciate it.
Good. Bye bye.
Bye.
Uh-huh. Okay.